So I'm glad to introduce you to Tom Fontana. Tom, I know that Oz was the first TV show to be produced for HBO. How did this come about?
I had wanted to do a show about the penal system in America for a very long time, and I went to all of the networks, NBC, which had been my home for many, many years, as well as CBS and ABC, and I pitched various versions of a show about prisons. Basically, they chased me out of the office with brooms. They were so not interested in doing a show about a prison. At the same time, HBO, Chris Albrecht, was looking to do their first drama series ever. And a very good friend of mine was in a meeting with Chris. And Chris said, you know, we've had a lot of success with our prison documentaries. Maybe we should do a prison show. And my friend, who had nothing to gain from it other than he knew my passion to write a show about prisons, said, I'll get right back to you. And he went outside and he called me and he said, get on a plane, because I live in New York City. He said, get on a plane and come to LA. I think we have someone stupid enough to do a prison show. So I flew out and I met with Chris, who I'd never met before, and his team. And I kind of laid out what I thought the show could be about. And he said, great. When do you want to start writing it? And I said, well, I need a little time to research because I want it to be as accurate and honest as possible, given the fact that it's on TV. I want it to be as honest as possible. And he said, well, how long do you need to research? And I said, well, maybe 2 years. So off I went on an expedition across America to go in and out of prisons, maximum security prisons. I went to what we call club feds, which are very low key, you know, for rich people, white collar criminals, trying to find exactly what would be the heart of the show. And eventually I sat down and I started writing the episode that you just saw. And HBO was incredibly supportive the whole time. Chris Albrecht said to me two things, which I had never heard before in all of my years as a television writer and producer. The first thing is he said was, I don't care if the characters are likable as long as they're interesting. Now, for a guy like me who had written broadcast television, that was an extraordinary statement. It was like giving heroin to a heroin addict. And the second thing he said was, we've never done a drama series, so we don't know anything about drama. So you have to teach us everything you know. And I was like, oh my God, I could die today and it would be the happiest day of my life.
So you hadn't experienced this kind of
freedom or collaboration, support. Normally when you go into, especially the broadcast networks and pitch a series, they the first meeting is always, we want something groundbreaking, we want something new, we want something different. And then you give them that and they go, oh no, but we don't want that. What we'd like is CSI Toledo. You know, Dick Wolf is a very good friend of mine, and I always tried to get him to do Law and Order Lost and Found, because I thought it would be great to do a series where somebody loses an umbrella and then they have to find it, you know. Chung chung.
So Did this prove to be real in the process then?
Absolutely. HBO was incredibly supportive throughout the whole run of Oz. I think in the course of the six seasons we did, they maybe gave me three notes the entire time. And what I felt was an extraordinary sense of responsibility to, at that time when we started, the as yet unnamed next story, next creator or showrunner, because I thought if I screwed it up, the next time somebody went in to see Chris Albrecht, they would go, "Yeah, we trusted Fontana, and it was horrible." So I also had this incredible sense of responsibility for the next generations of showrunners and creators that were going to come in the door. But fortunately, I fooled HBO, so it worked out for Chase and David Simon and David Milch.
I know that you wrote most of the stuff yourself. How did you manage to do that?
Well, I first of all, because I had done so much research and I had so many things in my head, and to be perfectly honest, and this is, I'll try to say this not as obscenely as it probably will come out, is when you're going to say this to a writer, I need you to write a scene where he takes him and rapes him in the ass, it's easier just to write it yourself than have to try to say that to another writer. So what I found was I would go, "I need you to write a scene." "No, never mind, I'll do that one." "I need you to..." "Nah, never mind, I'll do that one." So that part, but I think the biggest mistake that, again, broadcast television makes, though I'm not here to attack broadcast television, is they tend to start with very big writing staffs. They get a 13-episode order and they hire 13 episodes. I think the best shows, Sopranos, The Wire, start with a very small group of writers who and are centered on a guy like David Chase or a guy like David Simon, who has a clear vision of what the series is, so that the first year you're a very small group of writers developing the show, and then after that you bring in other people who have other ideas, because but I think initially, in order for the series to really be have a strong foundation creatively, it needs a small group of writers to be working on it.
And how did you find the confidence in the first place to get this idea to have these long term dramaturgies and this kind of storytelling? Did you have any examples like that before?
No, I mean the thing that was so liberating about Oz for me coming out of broadcast television, and I'm very proud of the shows. You know, I did St. Elsewhere and Homicide on broadcast television, so I'm very proud of them. But what happened was that people said to me when I first started doing Oz, "Oh, you must be so happy you can do all the swear words and you can do all of the the sex and the violence, and you don't have to worry about censors." And that actually wasn't what was the most exciting thing for me. What was the most exciting thing was, narratively, I was totally liberated. First of all, I didn't have commercials, so I wasn't forcing every... Back then it was 12 minutes, now it's 8 minutes, forcing a cliffhanger-y thing to get people to come back from the commercial. And second of all, I could do a lot of stories about a lot of different characters on a weekly basis for however amount of time that story needed to be told that week. In other words, I would tell a story about Beecher 1 week that would be 2 minutes long. And the next week, I could tell the story of Beecher for 20 minutes. And if that piece of the story needed 20 minutes, I could give it all 20 minutes. And that was extraordinarily, I mean, I had never experienced anything like that coming from broadcast television, where you could actually tell the story without having to worry about any of the constraints of commercial television. And the other thing that besides HBO's incredible support of what I was trying to do, the actors were extraordinarily courageous in encouraging me to go as far and as deep as I wanted to go. I was very lucky to have the cast I had because they were just so inventive and so joyous. It's so funny to think about. Here's a show where everybody's shanking and raping each other, and when the shooting would end, they'd all go out bowling together. They'd be like, "Ah, let's go bowling," you know. And I always thought that to be so amazing because they'd be like, "I'm gonna kill you! I'm gonna kill you!" Cut. Hey, let's go bowling, you know. Which I kind of loved the fact that they were such a community of artists that they really loved and enjoyed each other's company.
I think a couple of the actors weren't actors, but were taken from the real scenes they represent in the film as well.
Yeah.
So, like, I think bikers were bikers.
Yes.
How did they get along with the black actors and the black Muslims?
Well, it's a funny thing, because we had a very wide range of actors on the show. We had everybody from Rita Moreno, who has won the Emmy and the Oscar and the Tony and the, you know, every award that they could conceive of, she has won, and she's been in the business a long time and enormous experience. And then you have other actors who had never acted before, never been in front of a camera. And then what I had said to our casting, the woman who cast the atmosphere players, the extras, I had said to her, I don't want to see anybody who has been on Law & Order or has been on Days of Our Lives or any show that's done in New York, because in New York there's a whole group of people who only do the background work, and I said, I want the real people. I want Fellini faces. I want it to look like if you walk down a hallway in a prison you would see these faces. So she managed to get a lot of people, and we had like the Hell's Angels literally were extras on our show. They would come, and they, what was great about it was, in the heart of every single person, I think, is somebody, they just want to have one line of dialogue on a TV show. It's really all they want. So you'd have the president of the Hell's Angels in New York sitting with a guy who was just got out of prison for selling heroin, a African-American kid, and they'd be sitting there talking. And I would walk into the holding area where they would all sit in between shots, and I'd always kind of walk in going like, oh, okay, I'm so terrified. Because they're all ex-prisoners and stuff, and I'd be like, I'm just going to keep my head down and walk through. And they'd go, hey, Tom, hi, Tom, because they all wanted, can I get a line? I'd like, you know, my mother watches the show. Could I get a line? Because she'd really love it if I said something. So there was this odd kind of like, they all had to behave because they all wanted to have a line of dialogue. And I was totally intimidated by them, and they were totally intimidated by me.
And they forced you to go out late at night and stuff like that.
Yes. It was the most partying cast of actors I've ever been with in my life. And that was the other thing, is the lead actors really did. When you walked on that set, we shot on the old Nabisco cookie factory in Manhattan on a floor, and where they used to make Oreos and stuff like that. And once you walked onto that set, we were there for, you know, 10 hours. And you felt like you were in a prison. It was pretty intense. And what would happen is the major actors really became the protectors of the show. And I'll tell you a very quick story about a very famous rapper whose name I won't mention. Ice-T. No, actually, it was LL Cool J. But it really was LL Cool J. And he came on the show he really wanted to be on the show, and he asked me to write him a part, and I wrote him a part. And he came on with his posse, and one day, they had served on craft service, at lunch, they had served shrimp. Now, this was a huge expense, and I was shocked when I found out about this later, but anyway, there was this huge plate of shrimp on the table for everybody, the regular actors and the extras, to eat from. And one of LL Cool J's guys took the entire plate and took it into LL Cool J's dressing room. Well, you would have thought the regular actors, Dean Winters and Lee Tergesen and J.K. Simmons, and they walked into his dressing room like a gang of prisoners and said, I won't use the expletives, but they basically said, you give us that back. That's for the whole crew. And it was like this intense moment where I thought, oh my God, there's going to be like real blood. And of course, my attitude was, get the camera. Get the camera. Let's shoot it. Maybe we can use some of it. But anyway, they backed down, and we got the shrimp back. And it was a happy day after that. If I'm telling too long stories,
and
I don't know.
I think they're great.
We have a lot to cover.
Yeah, right.
We do.
Yeah, we should hurry up.
Because we haven't even gotten to when I was born.
I mentioned in my lecture, I mentioned your trick with the language. How did you get this idea? And also, I understood that there was some kind of consequence of
it. Yeah, it was funny because when I was going into the prisons to do research, what I discovered was that they created, much like on the street, if you were in Baltimore or in New York City, there are words created on the street and in prisons for certain things, and as soon as I would write down a word, I'd go, "Oh, that's such a cool word! I'm going to use that when I write the show." One example was Maytag. When somebody was, I don't know how offensive to be here, but when somebody was somebody's bitch, they would call them their Maytag, because they had to do their laundry. So they were a Maytag. And I just thought that was like incredibly cool, but it was a current word. And what I realized over the 2 years that I was doing the research was the words kept changing, as they do on the street, every 6 months. So a word that was current 2 years ago would now feel very kind of quaint, you know, prison quaint. In the same way as we were talking about, you know, if I said, oh, this is so groovy, you'd go, oh, that old man up there is using 60s phrase. So I decided, rather than use the actual words that I was hearing in prisons, was to invent a language for my characters to say, and that way they would be specific to the show. The audience would identify, go, oh, that word means that. And so that's how it came about. What the irony was, and if you can explain this to me, evidently prisons would allow prisoners to watch Oz. Now, I would have had them watching Touched by an Angel, but clearly some warden thought it was a good idea to see people watching Oz. I don't know. But ironically, the words I made up then became the slang inside real prisons. So my original idea of trying not to seem out of date eventually came anyway, because the words I made up then got to be out of date. But I felt very proud. It was like, it's like you said about, you know, Milch. You feel like, well, look at me. I just created a word. And Shakespeare. I'm like Shakespeare. I create words. They become part of the language.
Yeah, now you mentioned Milch, who did a similar operation on Deadwood with language.
Yes.
And, you know, which reminds
But his was much more intelligent. His was, no. His was classical. His was Shakespearean. Mine was cheesy and cheap.
And yours are very intelligent as well.
No. Tits is hardly a classical word.
No, it's not classical. It's not, the word is not intelligent. It's very intelligent.
To use that word. You know,
package,
I am so glad I came to Stuttgart. I feel so much better now.
But, you know, I also mentioned that Milch was facing some problems after Deadwood was going on for a while for his language. Being accused of using all this foul language all the time, and he had to kind of legitimate this. How was the reaction on Oz, which was 10 years before?
Yeah, well, first of all, I thought David's use of Dante to justify the word fuck was maybe the greatest idea. I mean, that's what I'm saying. He's so much smarter than I am, because I would have never thought to use Dante to justify a swear word. To me, it was brilliant. But what was interesting about Oz was, you know, because at that point nobody was watching HBO, we got very little trouble for using any bad words, and we used everything we could think of. Even though Oz helped them increase their subscribers, I used to say that the reason that Oz never got criticized by African Americans or anybody else was because we were an equal opportunity offender. We actually offended every ethnic group, every religious group you could think of. So you couldn't go, oh, Tom Fontana hates Catholics. You couldn't say that, because we attack Protestants, Jews, Muslims, everybody. I'll tell you another really quick story. The only thing we got was the Aryan Brotherhood threatened to our first season, threatened to kill Barry Levinson, my partner, and I, and because of the negative portrayal of the Aryan nation. And I was like, well, that's, you know, fine. And HBO called me, and they were all very nervous. And they were like, do you want bodyguards? How do you want us to handle this? And I said, no. If they kill Barry, then I'll get the bodyguards. But if they don't kill Barry, then I don't think they'll kill me. I don't know. But it was truly amazing not to... We didn't get the kind of criticism that David got for the language for some reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Going back to HBO and the situation then, you know, it seems very astonishing that one guy alone, like Chris Albrecht, who you know, was the boss then of
yeah.
HBO,
right? Yeah.
And who was so supportive, could decide on the long run something like that all by himself without having to face any kind of, you know, pressure from inside the company, from the marketing department, from, you know, all kinds of people. What was the situation like?
Well, it was extraordinary. I had never worked at a network where there weren't 12 people above the 12 people you had talked to get a show on the air. And Chris had the power at that moment. Later it devolved when they joined with AOL. He didn't have quite so much free reign, but at the time he had the power to say, yes, let's go forward. And what was extraordinary was, and this has never happened before or since in my career, we took the pilot for Oz to LA, and we watched it with Chris in the room, and he said yes. He asked us a couple questions, and then he said, yes, let's go to series. Now, normally what happens is you send the pilot off to Hollywood, and you have no idea when they're going to watch it, and you have no idea who's going to watch it, and it goes through 12 different hands. It goes through the marketing people, research people. It goes through a whole ton of people who have opinions. And normally in Hollywood is the city of no. And if they can figure out a way to say no and a reason to say no, they will say no. So for Chris to be able to say, I'm going to move forward with this, was an extraordinary moment for me, because he watched it and he believed in it and he just said yes.
And astonishingly enough, it seems like almost to this day, this kind of attitude prevailed, even though I think there were a lot of changes in HBO. Is it like that?
Well, HBO went through a kind of weird, like, success. The old saying, there's nothing worse than failure except success, where you suddenly are too successful and then you have to second guess every single decision you make. So they kind of went into this dip where they stopped trusting the creative people and started trusting other people. And so it went through a little kind of down, but now they're on the rise again. Though I haven't seen True Blood, I have to admit. Another vampire show, I can't deal with more vampires. After Buffy, there's nothing I want to watch.
I agree. Not only can I see and people see a lot of similarities and common things in at least these, what I consider the big four shows of HBO, but also it seems like you guys all have known each other for quite a long time. And what's the relation between
the other
Simon,
creators?
David Milch, David
well,
Simon, Chase.
David Chase, I only knew peripherally in Hollywood. I was a huge fan of his series, Almost Grown, and unfortunately, the series has not been put on DVD or ever showed again. And I don't even know how many, maybe you know how many episodes they made. They didn't make a whole season, I don't think. It was an extraordinarily bold attempt on broadcast television to tell the story of a marriage in three different time periods, maybe more different time periods, but when they met in college, when they were married, and when they were divorced. And it was so, I remember watching it going like, the writing was wonderful, the acting was wonderful, and of course, it got canceled relatively quickly. And I called David, who I did not know, and I said, I just want you to know, I love your show. And he was like, oh my God, thank you for calling. And that was the first conversation we ever had. And when he moved back to New York, we got to know each other better, and we're good friends now. David Simon wrote the original nonfiction book, Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets. And if you've never read the book, and I don't get any royalties for selling the book, so this is totally an honest opinion. It's one of the best nonfiction books about crime in America that I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them. Anyway, Barry Levinson bought the rights to this book, Homicide, and it was my job to turn it into a TV series. And David was at the time still a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and David had a healthy and aggressive attitude toward television. I think he understood early on that television would eventually kill the newspaper, as the internet is killing television now. But he was very suspect of everything and very protective of everybody in the book. And he and I got to be friends almost through adversity, but we're very dear friends now. We're actually doing a miniseries for HBO. We're in the midst of writing it about the aftermath of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, with a lot of parallels to both September 11th and the Bush administration. I won't say any more about it. Tune in. And who else are we talking about?
Milch.
David Milch and I are both from a wonderful, sunny little town in America called Buffalo. where it never snows. And anyway, he and I have known each other probably the longest. And we've owned racehorses together. And we actually, when I was doing St. Elsewhere at MTM, he was doing Hill Street. And we both had offices in the same building on the MTM lot. So we got to spend a lot of time together. And David, of all the Davids, and I'll throw David Kelly into this quartet of Davids, David Milch is truly the most unusual human being you would ever get to meet. He is, he's just an extraordinary, he has an extraordinary mind, he has an extraordinary soul, he is a survivor beyond anything that I could ever even dream of surviving. He has survived it. And anyway, he's extraordinary. I wanted to change my name to David, by the way. I thought it might help my career, but I didn't.
Yeah, we, when we thought about making this film on you guys, we thought it, to call it The Davids. The only problem was that there was...
I'm sorry about that.
Too bad, really. Well, we will be able to maybe to hear a little bit more about the way David Milch works when we will speak to... we will hear Ted Mann telling us his experiences working on Deadwood.
Yes.
You know, at some point, I developed this kind of, I don't know if this is a theory or this idea that since you guys were born between like 47 and 51 or something like that.
Well, David Simon's younger. How old is David?
He's my age. We're the same age.
And you want to admit now? Okay.
1960.
So, okay.
Oh, okay.
See? He's a baby, David. So David Simon. It's Milch that's the old man.
Okay.
You have to help him in and out of cars now.
All right. So maybe my theory is already...
No, but I think you're right. There was a kind of period in, you know, where... because the 60s, still at the beginning of the 60s, before... you know, the Kennedy assassinations and the death of Martin Luther King, we were all in the same kind of mindset growing up.
How do you know that I was going to...
I don't know. That? I was assuming, which is terrible. I take it back.
No, but you're
What were we talking about?
You absolutely hit the black in the... No, this is what I was going to say, that I thought there was some kind of like-mindedness to be felt from what I consider, what I would think the working procedure is like. You know, you all of you favor, but also a certain, critical political approach to things, you know, wanting to, tell stories in a way that, you know, it says something about the society this happens in. And, you know, a certain empathy for the characters, you know, and the refusal to say you have really good characters and you have bad characters and all these kind of things which seem to me
well,
to be informed.
I think that's true on two levels. One is in terms of being a kid in America from through the 50s. We were kind of lulled into this false sense of complacency and the Eisenhower presidency and that the world made a kind of sense to us. And what happened starting in the 60s with the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy through the race riots and everything else that happened, Watergate and everything, all of us who were maturing at that period were completely like confused by what was happening politically, because we were raised to believe that we had it figured out, that America had it figured out, and we very quickly realized we didn't have it figured out. I think the other thing, the other element of that is that we had all watched television from its, well, not youthful David Simon, but the rest of us had watched television pretty much from its inception. And I could, so by the time we got to writing cop shows or doctor shows or lawyer shows, we had seen all of the cliches done on American television 50, 60 times. I mean, you couldn't fool us by, you know, whether it was Jack Webb or whoever it was, we had seen it already. And so I think there were those of us who were like, well, wait a minute, we don't want to just do the same old, same old. We said, well, how do we do this totally differently than it's ever been done before? And also, how do we do it differently from each other? And I think that's the other thing is that you can't look at Chase or Milch or Simon and say, oh, they all write the same kind of TV show, because they don't. And I think that's the great testament to television now, is that there is so much room to move, that people like them have, each of them, one paints, the other sculptures, and the other does etchings, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's extraordinary about television now.
Maybe we should start opening the discussion from our dialogue here, and you know, if there's any questions, please come up.
I didn't hear the last part.
What? Locked Up Abroad.
Do I know what that is?
Do you know that? Yeah.
No, I don't.
You don't know that show? It has a really good format. They take real prisoners, put them in front of a camera in an interview situation. But when they talk about their story and how they came into prison, they are outside the U.S. in prison. They are in Brazil or in Peru or wherever, you have a fictional part where actors really play what they basically at the same time as a voiceover talk, mm-hmm. and then you cut back to the interview and then back to, you don't know it?
I don't. It sounds a little bit like a show we have called Cops, which I don't know if it airs over here.
It just airs in, I've seen it in New York so a few times. I think it's on air right now. So.
Yeah. I don't know.
What a pity.
Yeah, sorry.
I wanted to hear your opinion. Wow.
Yeah.
Hi. I was really interested.
I think he's coming. Yeah.
I'm interested in your experience at MBC and MTM, because you seem to have been really lucky to have been at these kind of moments, and obviously I think that's also saying something about you, but to be at these kind of moments where something new is happening in television, because I'm thinking of St. Elsewhere, and I just wondered if you could say a little bit about that experience of working on St. Elsewhere, which seems to sort of... parallel
with
the sort of HBO experience.
It is totally. First of all, St. Elsewhere, for those of you, because most of the audience is too young to have ever even heard of St. Elsewhere. It was a medical show that we did in the United States, and what it was known for, much like Hill Street Blues, it was known for taking the medical genre and completely throwing everything out the window, the shooting style. And also the characters. American medical shows up to that point had heroic elderly doctors telling the stupid patients what they needed to do in order to survive. And St. Elsewhere was a show about very human doctors who weren't, and nurses who weren't always right about anything. And Anyway, I was very, very blessed because up to that point, I had been a playwright in New York, and I was a very successful at starving as a playwright in New York. I had starving down to a truly an art form, and I was very lucky that Bruce Paltrow plucked me out of obscurity and brought me to Los Angeles to work on the first season and all the subsequent seasons of St. Elsewhere. And at that moment in time, Grant Tinker, who was the head of MTM Enterprises, which was the studio that did the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Bob Newhart Show and Lou Grant and what was considered quality television, had just moved to be head of NBC. And Brandon Tartikoff, who was his second in command, both of them loved television. And I only say that because there are not a lot of executives working in Hollywood who actually love television. They mostly, they don't hate it, but they have an indifference to it. And Grant and Brandon both genuinely, genuinely loved television. And they really loved writers in a way that Chris Albrecht later did with HBO. So I was totally, it had nothing to do with me, it had total to do with luck, that my first job was at MTM doing a show on NBC, and the other big job of my life was doing Oz for HBO. It's funny to me to think that Hollywood still doesn't understand that if you let the creative people do what they do, they actually get not only something that is worthwhile, but actually can make them some money. They still, a lot of them believe, and this is what HBO went through for a period, where they started to believe themselves that they were the creative people. And then it starts to get all kind of, you know, Dorothy Parker once said, the thing about Hollywood, the key word in Hollywood is another. Let's do another. If it's successful, just do another of those. And that's not the way. I consciously haven't done a medical show since St. Elsewhere, because I did a medical show, and I would do another one if I could come up with something that was hopefully better than St. Elsewhere. And I haven't done another prison show, but nobody's asked me. So, actually, at one point, they wanted me to do women's prisons, and I said, hey, you know, that feels... Anyway.
We were now talking a lot about old series. But what do you think about the new, like Lost and Prison Break, Prison Again?
Prison Break I actually never watched, I have to say, because when you do a show about prison, the last thing, it's like if you work at a chocolate factory, you don't want to, you work at Cadbury, you don't want to eat a Hershey bar, you know? So I never watched Prison Break. Lost I thought was extraordinary, though it was a lot of work to have to stay with it. So I have to admit I kind of stopped watching it. I tend now to wait till the DVD is out and watch the whole thing on DVD. I do that with Mad Men and a lot of the other shows. But again, it's not what I think is great about the kind of work that's coming out now is that it's all so different. You know, Lost is not Mad Men, it's not Breaking Bad. They're all different shows, and you have to love the fact that we're not watching the same show. You know, back when I was a kid, there was a Western that was successful, and there were 15 Westerns on the air, and eventually killed the Western because we all got tired of watching them. So I think the diversity of the shows that are out there is extraordinary.
Okay, thanks.
I hope that answers.
One more question,
yeah.
Because you just mentioned it. Do you think that the way new series come out, that you just watch the whole season on DVD, does it change how people see TV series, that they don't watch it on television anymore? Like, it's Monday, 8 o'clock, we have to watch the show, we just wait for the DVD to come out?
Well, I think there's two kinds of mentalities now about watching television. There's old stupid people like me who just want to watch it as if I was reading a novel. So I want to read it and watch it at my own pace. So I'd rather wait. But I think because there is a whole group of people who want to talk about it on the internet, they can't wait to watch that week's episode. You know what I mean? So that they can then 10 minutes after it's over or 2 minutes after it's over, go like, oh, I hated when that happened and why did they do that and do that? So I think that's great. I think it satisfies both appetites. So I do think there is a reason to have shows on, to be the first one to watch it. In the same way that people get in line to watch to buy the first weekend of a movie, you know, so they can say, oh, I saw Harry Potter or whatever or Avatar or whatever, because it's a way to communicate culturally amongst ourselves. I don't care about communicating, so I buy the DVD.
I'm sorry.
No.
So I think the first was another David we have here, David Lavery. Then the gentleman in the blue sweater. This is you. Then you, and also okay. Then this would be number four back there. Okay, please, David.
And then there's alcohol.
I hope so.
All right. Very good.
Thank you. I recently learned a helpful term, actor residue. It's when you see an actor and you've carried over what they did from a previous role, and so it sort of influences how you read it. And having just watched all of Oz in 2 weeks in preparation for being here.
Poor man.
I feel like I was in prison. I was wondering about that because it just amazed me from Edie Falco to Harold Perrineau, to Chris Otto Wally. Yeah. Do you feel like that? Like you created modern television from the casting alone?
Well, the only thing I can actually say is Richard Belzer has played Munch in 8 different television shows. So that's the only one I actually can take the blame or credit for. I think my job as a... first of all, I think television makes stars. And I think every time television decides they're going to hire somebody famous to be in a TV series, the audience doesn't care. The audience, television audience, I think, wants to discover its own heroes and villains and actors that they love and that they hate. So I think my job, especially when you're going to do a series about a prison, you want almost the people to be faceless. You can afford to hire a Rita Moreno because her role was kind of elevated above the mass of faces that were in the prison. But for the most part, whether it was all the way back to St. Elsewhere, where we hired a young journeyman actor named Denzel Washington, who I think turned out okay. I don't know. Has he been working? I think. A little bit. But I think the point is that you hire the right actor for the job, and then you trust that actor and you write for that actor over the course of the series, and then when they go beyond that, because you don't want the worst thing is when an actor does a series for you and never gets another job again, and you feel like, oh my God, I killed his or her career. So what you want to make sure is that you keep it showing the range that the actor has. So the next producer will go, oh, you know, I want that actor now to be on my show. And so I would hope that all of the actors that you mentioned and all the other actors that have worked for me, people have forgotten their performances on Oz and only know their current performance.
Would you pass it back to this gentleman behind you?
You were talking about the internet killing television, which is truly not the case in Germany as we experience it here. But how did you experience the influence of the internet in the US, and how did the television broadcasters adapt to that development?
Well, I think that's a question I can't answer because we're in the middle of it. I don't think What's wonderful is to see network executives in Hollywood who have all the answers and they don't know the answer to that. So there's a kind of panic in their eyes that's kind of wonderful to watch. But I will say this: what I have a dirty little secret. I don't actually even own a computer. I still write longhand. I am the biggest dinosaur you could possibly see. But what I love about the internet is that it gives you another way to tell another piece of the same story. When we did Homicide, now this is a long time ago, we did a thing called Second Shift, which we had a different group of actors on the internet solving a different murder. And they weren't called webisodes back then because the word didn't exist, but we did a series of webisodes that we shot on our set, and it just existed out there by itself. Eventually, we had some of our regular characters on the TV series appear on the internet series, and then we had some of the internet characters appear on the TV series. With Oz, what we did was two things. We had a virtual Oz, which you could go onto the internet and you could walk around the prison. Why you'd want to do that, I don't know, but we did it. And the other thing we did is we were introducing a character of an undercover cop, and we shot three scenes which we put on the internet. One was him with his family, his wife and young child, saying goodbye to them. One was with his boss, and one was with his partner. And unless you saw those three pieces on the internet, you had no idea when the character came on the series that he was an undercover cop, because we didn't reveal it on the series until much later. But we just wanted to like have a little something else out there for people who were looking at the internet. So to go back to your question, I think the joy of it can be that if you can figure out, in the same way that if you come out with a hardcover copy, you know, a book based on the Wire, like a novel, that's another piece of the story that you weren't able to tell on the series. As long as it all works kind of in conjunction together, I think it's a wonderful thing. How it's going to affect the economics and how it's going to affect who watches what when, I'm so the wrong guy to answer that question, but hopefully over the weekend somebody will.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Boris. I got a particular question of collaborating with, hi, here, over here, collaborating with the director in creating a series. As a showrunner, you have access to all the creative decisions throughout the whole process, of course, but particularly with the pilot episode, how did you find your director, and then what kind of input did he have, actually? Because it's differing from feature films, I suppose.
Yeah. It's totally a different situation. And again, I don't have a good answer. It's a little bit of a crapshoot. With Homicide, Barry Levinson directed the pilot, so that wasn't so much a problem. With Oz, Darnell Martin directed the pilot, and she's this very talented young African American. And she and I had a lot of conversations. It was a big risk hiring her because she had never done a pilot before, and we had a lot of conversations. We had a lot of disagreements, and I had to be very observant every minute of the day just to make sure that I was getting what I wanted and she was also doing what she thought was right. So it's an odd marriage unless you have a long-term relationship with a director, and there are a couple that I do, but I've had pilots just totally be horrible because I picked the wrong director. And after that, what happens is the director becomes really a guest in your house, because the actors and the showrunner and the writers are all together every week. So the director becomes this like, oh, look, Uncle Fred is coming for a visit. Let's all treat him nicely and make sure he leaves on Tuesday when he's supposed to.
Thank you very much.
Hi. I would like to know something about your writing process. So do you write serious Bibles? How detailed are your outlines? When do you begin to write the script? And to what degree do you let the actors' performances influence the character arcs?
Okay. It's a lot of questions. I'll try to do them. First of all, I get up every single day of my life at 5:30, and I write. And this is even back in the days when I stayed out till 4:30. I still used to get up at 5:30. But fortunately, I was writing Oz at the time, so it didn't matter that I was hungover. So I have a dedicated time every morning to writing. And then when I stop writing, I put on my producer head and become a producer. I don't like to mix the two because I think they're different animals. I think it's important. I'm trying to remember the question.
It was about
help
the
me
serious
out.
Bibles. And
oh,
the
Bibles, yes. I think what's really important is to have a sense of where the series can go, but not have it in concrete. Because what happens is the minute that you add the actual actors to the mix, it starts to change. And if you're too rigidly believing in your Bible, but you have an actor who suddenly is doing something extraordinary and you haven't factored that in, or conversely, if you have an actor who's not doing as well in that part as you thought he would do, you're suddenly stuck with a lot of stuff that isn't working. I think the key to doing episodic television is it's never finished. It's never finished when you've written the script. It's never finished while you're shooting it. It's never finished when you edit it. And I would, listen, tomorrow I would go back and reshoot all of Oz if I was given the opportunity to do it. I just think it's a continual process of discovery. I love the contribution actors make to the process. I think initially, in the first season, you are the dominant person because you're defining the character. But I think by the second season, you need to listen to your actors about what they know about the character because they're concentrating on that character and you're concentrating on the whole universe. And so if an actor comes to you and says, you know, not, oh, I don't think my character would do this, but says, wait a minute, have we really explored, you know, X? You'd be a stupid writer-producer not to listen to that person. I actually have a meeting every season, at the beginning of every season of the shows I do, where I bring in all the principal actors, just one at a time, and I say to them, what aria haven't you sung? What dance haven't you danced? Because I know that left to myself, I'll just keep doing the good stuff. I've seen you do this good stuff, so I'll just keep doing writing toward that. But if an actor says to me, well, you know, I actually never get to be funny. Could you write me some funny stuff? I mean, that's a bad example. I'll give you the prime example, and it's not Oz, but it was Homicide. Andre Brouwer, who is one of the greatest actors I've ever worked with, was pretty much, for the first five seasons of the show, you put him in the box, in the interrogation room, and he owned it. He just totally owned it. I mean, he was articulate and funny and scary and brilliant in those scenes. And we used to love writing for him and trying to trip him up. I mean, you could never trip him up. No matter how hard it was, that you, whatever you gave him, he always did a better job than what you had written. So we're having our annual meeting, and he said to me, you know, I'm just so tired of always being right in the box. I'm just tired of winning. I'm tired of it being, you know. And I said, okay. And I said, what if I gave you a stroke? What if I gave your character a stroke where he lost his ability to speak? He lost his ability to reason. But being the guy that Pembleton was, had to get back in the game. So what we did in the last episode of whatever season it was, we gave him a stroke. He had the stroke in the box. And then we assumed that over the summer, during the when the show was on hiatus, that his character was in was going through rehabilitation. And the first episode of the next season was his first day back. And he couldn't do anything he had done before. And the idea of taking your most articulate character and turning him into your least articulate character was, on one hand, so much fun, and on the other hand, the stupidest thing I've ever done in my entire career. Because suddenly you're like, you know, you're all of the stuff that you, let's just write a scene with Andre and the thing, and, you know, let's get out of this, you know. We couldn't do that. And for the actor, he was loving it because it gave him something to play that he had never played anywhere else, but also had never played on the show. So I think that's ultimately my point, my long-winded way of saying, I think that the actor becomes absolutely your partner over the life of the series, but also becomes your mentor in a way, because he or she starts to tell you things that you never thought about for those characters.
Hi, I was wondering what happened to your approach to the show once you realized that prison life was imitating your art. Did you feel a heightened sense of responsibility, a moral burden, or did you try to block that out and stay true to the show?
Hopefully both. That's kind of the wuss answer, but hopefully both. It became the thing I struggled with, and sometimes I was better at it than not. The hardest thing about it was, because we had the first African-American Muslim character in television on the show, after September 11th, I had to make a decision about whether I was going to deal with September 11th on the show. And I made a conscious decision not to, but that was less out of any kind of practical reasoning. It had more to do with the fact that I simply could not write about September 11th at that time. I couldn't. I was obviously living in New York and still live in New York, and I actually saw the second tower fall down with my own eyes, and so it was the kind of thing and remains the kind of thing that I am still incapable of writing about. Maybe someday I will, someday I won't. But anyway, that was the only moment where I said to myself, no, I can't go there because I don't have the tools emotionally to go there. And I didn't want to get into a situation where I was suddenly, you know, spewing and mewling and puking all over the TV. So that was everything else was just guessing on a moment-to-moment basis.
I would say since Tom wants to drink alcohol,
yes,
we have a final possibility, as they say in an A, for burning desires.
Oh.
Yes, please.
Yes, I can. Yeah, because we were 99.9% of the show was done on the set. We shot 6 days, which now seems preposterous, but we did. The budget I won't speak to because it was so long ago that it's a meaningless number in today's economy. So I won't even tell you the number because it's a useless piece of information. What we did do when we did go outside, because the only thing is, the only time we went outside was to see the crime. We would budget a day where we would go out and shoot whatever crime pieces there were done. The first three seasons we shot in the old Nabisco Cookie Factory in Manhattan. And then after that, we lost that space, and we moved out to an old U.S. Army base in Bayonne, New Jersey. So if you watch, if you watch the series like David did, you'll see that the crimes initially are very urban, and then the crimes later are much more kind of not urban, because we were shooting on this army base. So, but those were the practical considerations.
May I use your phone?
Yes.
I got robbed of mine.
Oh, you did.
So, I'd like to thank you, Tom, very, very much for coming all the way here to us.